Well, hey, everybody. Welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines, the Tuesday 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and on the web at kpfk.org. And this is your host, Eric Mann. Today, I'm very pleased to continue the conversation I started a couple of weeks ago in a Voices show about Dorsey High School and the attack on inner-city public schools called, quote, reconstitution. Joining me today in the KPFK studio is Alex Caputo-Pearl, a lead teacher of the Social Justice Academy at Crenshaw High School, and Reverend Eric Lee, president of the Los Angeles branch of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. We'll talk about recent efforts by Superintendent Daisy to undermine Crenshaw High School's extended learning cultural model and to implement reconstitution at the school. We'll also discuss the community movement against reconstitution and what demands and alternative policies the community is fighting for. And I'll end by saying that before we get to the next one. And remember, on Voices from the Frontlines, you're going to be asked to do something. We don't just talk about things. There'll be action proposals, and this movement needs your help. In our second segment, I'll share with you a recent conversation I had about global capitalism and U.S. empire with two old friends and comrades of mine, Leo Panitch and Sam Ginden. They're both political economists at York University in Toronto, Canada, and have recently published a new book, The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire. So we're going to take a brief break in a moment. Stay tuned from Voices from the Frontlines. I'm going to discuss Crenshaw High and the struggle against reconstitution. So welcome back to Voices from the Frontlines, coming to you at 4 p.m. every Tuesday on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and the web on kpfk.org, and I'm still your host, Eric Mann. Now, you can check out previous Voices shows or subscribe to our podcast at www.thestrategycenter.org. We can also get on our Voices email list, which we would like. You can listen immediately to past Voices show by going onto the archives pages of the KPFK website. You can also find my radio shows, commentaries, articles, and books at my website, voicesfromfrontlines.com, voicesfromfrontlines.com. So let's get to Reverend Eric Lee and Alex Caputo-Pearl. The situation is really scary to me. It's really amazing the work you've done, the great work you've done. And this doesn't seem like, it seems like, what does it say, no good deed goes unpunished. So help me try to understand, Reverend Lee, why don't you start with, how did you get involved in this struggle? And explain to our listeners what's up, what's at stake at Crenshaw High School? What do you see the stakes of this fight being about?
Well, I got involved with it, with Crenshaw probably 2005, 7 years ago.
Wow.
And it's been an ongoing struggle to... for the community to determine what this school is supposed to represent within our own community. It's always been a collaboration of parents, teachers, community, students to create the best possible environment for our children to improve in their academic performance. And for a number of reasons that we can look at, public schools have been struggling, particularly when it comes to African American and Latino students. With Dr. Daisy coming in as superintendent, he has summarily issued a mandate that he's going to assume immediate control over Crenshaw High School. They use the term reconfiguration, where they're planning on bringing in three magnet schools.
Right.
But when you require the teachers, the staff, classified to reapply for their jobs, it's just another version of reconstitution. And it's going to be very disruptive to the school. It destabilizes the school, and it eliminates all of the good work that we've done over the last few years, particularly with the teachers, in laying a foundation for what we call an extended learning model. And so what's at stake here is the very livelihood of Crenshaw High School as we know it. What's at stake is the elimination of the progress that we've already made through this extended learning model. And what's at stake is one of your oldest and most significant high schools will be taken over by the district, who has no plan that they've shared with us on how they plan to improve the academic performance of our students.
Well, Alex Caputo Pearl, I've known you for a long time. You've really given your heart and soul to Crenshaw High School. This is what I don't understand. I mean, I've studied this a little bit. There's all kinds of very exciting programs, lots of people involved. I mean, a lot of times the inner city schools are pretty abandoned, and you've built this amazing coalition. You got experimental school classes. You got, I mean, you can go, you'll tell me better than, but why the attack on this when this is sort of, in my opinion, the model, not just sort of you're hanging by a thread? So what's, first of all, tell our listeners what's good about Crenshaw High School and the work that you've done. And then secondly, so what's the beef?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. We've built, as Reverend Lee said, we've built over the last few years, coming out of many more years of coalition building, we've built something called the Extended Learning Cultural Model. And what the what that basically means is that we're working with students on, you know, all of the things that end up being the state requirements and the standards and so on in the classrooms, but doing it in a way that is culturally relevant, that specifically is working with teachers around cultural relevance and working with students in new and innovative ways, that includes things like positive behavior support instead of supporting the school to prison pipeline and just some, you know, summary punishments of students in class, instead working on a positive behavior support model. And the extended learning comes in because it's preparing students through what they do in class to then go out into the community and into businesses, local businesses, and actually do academic projects through internships, through community action, through studying different policy issues, through often contributing to pretty major business plans for the community, pretty major national studies on food deserts and equity issues in the community. So that's the extended part of. So extending learning outside the classroom and extending the community into the classroom. Now, and we've actually managed to build, to get some private funding to support this, is Ford Foundation money, as well as public funding, some Obama money through a federal school improvement grant. The beef with it, which is the other part of your question, is this represents a model that is contrary to what Superintendent Daisy is promoting. He comes out of a movement that is funded hugely by the Gates Foundation, right, the Broad Foundation, and others. And it's basically a scorched earth model. It's basically trying to forget about the decades of institutional racism that have defined the funding that inner city schools get, the decades of institutional racism and neglect, to basically forget about that and just say that the way we're going to deal with this is scorched earth in the present. We're just going to drop bombs on schools, basically get rid of teachers, get rid of classified employees who are your janitors and your aides, your instructional aides, that if we just get rid of them in high profile actions, that will somehow turn a school around, that will somehow send the message politically that we're playing hardball with our schools and we're turning it around. And that scorched earth model, it's not supported by research. There was just a major new study that came out of the Annenberg Institute at Brown University and UC Berkeley that basically says that these kind of reconstitutions don't work. Of course they don't work. It's taking a community school and cutting the school off from the community. You've got veteran African-American teachers and aides who have been at Crenshaw for many years, have whole programs built around themselves, who would be displaced from this. You've got instructional aides and janitors who graduated from Crenshaw, who have a stake in the community, who actually see themselves as, you know, doing more at the school than just their paid work at the school. You're cutting them off from the school and making it much less of a community school than it should be and that we want.
Well, let me ask both of you this question that, I mean, given the disintegration of the social welfare state, the enormous attack on the Black and Latino family, these kids are not coming exactly to school from a positive situation at home. The families are working two and three jobs. the parents are creating a positive, the most positive thing they can do. But you're already developing kids coming in at a tremendous disadvantage. You have all this excitement that you're organizing. Now, what's the fight about performance? How, in other words, one of the things, it seems to me that they just want to get rid of the whole civil rights orientation of the school. But how are they going to argue this issue of performance that you've, I think their argument would be, well, you've had your chance, you're doing a lot of interesting things, but the kids are not performing, and we think they can. How do you address that, Reverend?
Well, you see, what's interesting is the timing about all this, because the there's a group called GCEP, which was the Greater Crenshaw Educational Partnership, who have received an MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, to operate the school in collaboration with USC and other community groups, the Los Angeles Urban League. And that was a five-year MOU. Well, we're in the fourth year, and we've seen over the last couple of years positive improvement in performance. And so it's interesting that now, as we start to see the uptick in performance, that the superintendent says, well, yes, there's performance, but there's an improvement in performance, but it's not fast enough. So what's going to happen is when he comes in, if he comes in, to reconstitute this school, the performance is already uptick, and it's going to look like reconstitution is the answer. And so timing is the issue. I don't understand why he's not willing to allow us, as we've laid the foundation and we have the partnerships in place, to let the school perform as the culturally relevant model has purposed it to do. The other thing about performance, we're talking about an antiquated public school system that does not interact or understand the children of this generation, and they do not understand how to educate black children. Right. And so this model that we're talking about, this extended learning model that Alex was talking about, is based on reciprocity between the community, a reciprocity of learning between the community and the school, and the school and the community. The children will share their experiences from their backgrounds and their communities in the classroom, so that there's an engagement, an equitable engagement between teacher and student. And as we see the children responding to this, there is a culture of learning and a culture of excitement that is going to be literally destroyed with what's going on now with Dr. Dacey's intent to reconstitute this school. So we can't narrowly define performance through just the data. We have to look at the child's learning experiences as a whole person. And what the public school system does not do is look at the child as a whole person, the experiences that they bring into the classroom, and how they can then impact the community based on what they learn in the classroom.
Which could be easily evaluated. I mean, it's not like that couldn't be quantified through interviews with the kids, through understandings of development. It's not like you can't see a child's development besides their academic development if they really cared. Is that fair?
That's fair. What they're doing is they're using old wineskin. They want to use a cookie-cutter boilerplate system of public education on children that it's not designed for. And so people learn in different ways, in different methods. And so all we're doing with the extended learning model is proving that children all can learn at high academic levels. It's how you approach the learning process. And so to come in and reconstitute the school because it's not moving fast enough, and I firmly believe that there's a political agenda behind it, and that, you know, these superintendents, we've had, what, maybe four superintendents in 5 or 6 years?
Wow.
And so what happens is they make these draconian changes in our schools and leave to another position,
right,
and the damage is done, and we're left to pick up the pieces. And so we need to rally our community, our parents, our students, our teachers, and say they can't come in and dictate what our school is supposed to look like and how our children learn. And to come in and make these decisions without engaging the community and the teachers is a very dangerous mistake.
Alex, I just want to get a factual question and ask you another question. Is it correct to say, and Reverend, that you are also saying that it's like you're in the third and a half year of a five-year MOU? Is that correct?
We're in the last year of a five-year MOU.
Oh, this is the last year.
Yeah. Okay. And indicators, both using traditional test score indicators and using some of the non-traditional measurements that you were just mentioning, Eric, like student surveys, number of internships participated in, that sort of thing, parent involvement. On last year, on most of those measures, the vast majority of those measures, Crenshaw was going up. We know there's a ton of work to do. Anybody who's been involved in the public school system, as you said, knows that when you're fighting tooth and nail against underfunding and the challenges that the kids are going through, there's always going to be a lot of work to do. But the point is there's a trajectory of growth using an innovative and culturally relevant model, and this superintendent wants to destroy it.
So let's get to, I want to make sure we have enough time about what to do, because let's talk about his perception of his statutory authority. Is there any challenge over that? I know you had an emergency meeting 3 or 4 weeks ago. Tell us as an organizer, both of you as organizers, what's the tactical plan to win?
So there's a couple of things going on. One is, obviously we're organizing on the ground, and we've got a strong coalition. One of the organizations that Reverend Lee represents, the Black Clergy Community and Labor Alliance, has convened a group along with the Teachers Union and a number of other groups, including the Labor Community Strategy Center, to do some real ground game organizing. We do need to get to the school board. The superintendent may try to say that he doesn't have to take this through the school board. The precedent is that he has to. So we're working at the school board level. There's an interesting handle as well on the Obama money, the federal money, the school improvement grant. We believe that since we just got that money literally less than 4 months ago, and it's for a period of 3 years, and it's a lot of money for a cash-starved school. It's almost $6 million.
That's great.
That for the superintendent to come in less than 4 months after a school community has written a school plan saying this is what we're doing and this is how we're going to use this money, for him to come in less than 4 months after the state said that sounds good, your structure and your plan sound good, and for him to say I'm going to drop a bomb on your structure and your plan raises some very serious questions at the state and federal levels that we're also looking into.
And I will say, and as Alex said, I represent a group called the Black Community, Clergy, and Labor Alliance. And it's a coalition of organizations that are committed to defending the rights and speaking out on the issues pertaining to African Americans in particular. And on this issue, we have engaged, as Alex said with the UTLA, and we're committed to the cause of holding the district accountable for how they enter into our community. Because I think we're all on the same page about needing to improve anywhere the scores for African-American children. But how you go about doing that is what's at issue and the process in which it's done. We will not be disrespected or discounted or disregarded by any institution and how they treat our children in our communities. So we're going to stand strong on that.
Well, again, what keeps confusing is maybe not the right word, because I'm not totally confused about what John Daly's doing, but I just want to say from the outside again, it's so impressive. This is what I'm, a little confused about. There are some schools that are pretty barren, where there's bad test scores and there's just very little going on. But Crenshaw has been like a hotbed of community involvement, so many different experiments, so many efforts to figure out educational theory, business theory, build a broad united front, is very aggressive. It's almost like saying we don't want this level of involvement, after claiming that you want involvement. So given that SCLC is a civil rights organization, CEJ is a civil rights organization, the Strategy Center is a civil rights organization, how do we explain this more clearly as a civil rights issue? And where would people go if they say, all right, I want to help, what do I do?
Well, I can tell you that on November 27th, we're having a town hall meeting, a community meeting over at the African American Culture Center. And, that's the address is, it's on, Vern, I think it's
3018 West 48th
Street. And, And so on the 27th at 6:30 in the evening, we're having a community meeting to educate our community about what's going on, and then to develop a strategy from the community on how we fight back against what's going on at Crenshaw. You have to understand that Dr. Dacey has a pattern of doing this, because at Clay Middle School, during the time Clay was going through its reformation, there was a component in the school district that allowed for parent advisory committee to take place and to have some a voice in what happens at the school.
Right.
Dr. Dacey eliminated the power, just gutted the power of the parent advisory group. And so there's a pattern that we see developing, if not developed, that is implemented, that we need to challenge, because the school and the community are one. And so how you treat our schools and our children is how you treat our communities. And so this is something that is a very tenuous situation that we have to deal with.
What day is November 27th?
It's a Tuesday, and I can give a number
that people
can call.
Yeah.
It's Tuesday, November 27th at 6:30, and the number to call for more information is 424-240-8510, 424-240-8510. And I was just going to say one other thing. There's a on the civil rights question that you brought up. This is a frontline civil rights struggle because of the students and families involved, because, as you say, there's a coalition built that's not just built around, that is built around building a different model of educating our young people in a way that's liberatory, that not just takes into account but celebrates culture.
Right.
This is a model that is that kind of model, and that is involving parents and community and students. And it's also a coalition that's fighting for one of the big issues in public education, which is more funding.
Right.
And more systemic support for so those are the civil rights issues at stake. The superintendent has done something else that, I mean, Reverend Lee used the word disrespect, and there are two absolute forefront African American academics who have been working with this school, who are not just academics who sit in the tower and you know write about things, but who are actually at the school working, writing, developing leaders, Dr. Sylvia Rousseau and Dr. Lewis King. And these two wonderful people have basically just been shunned. I mean, by the superintendent coming in and saying, "I got this. Whatever you guys have been doing, maybe it's fun, but I got this." That is a massive move of disrespect.
Well, in fact, the extended learning model was developed by Dr. Rousseau and Dr. King. And there was a point where there was an attempt to provide Dr. Dacey with the documentation on the benefits of the extended learning model, and he's refused to receive it. And so where it becomes a civil rights issue is when you have an administrator that seeks to implement a structure that they feel is best for our community without engaging us in the development of that structure.
Well, one thing is interesting is that, you know, during the 60s, the community control of school movement, like IS 139, I think it was in Harlem, there was a big fight between the union and the parents and the community. And here you have the union. Sounds like you have the union and the community all on the same side. And I guess what I'm trying to say is all the things that you're supposed to have happen are happening, and maybe that's what Dacey doesn't like about it, that all the good things are happening. So let's show our listeners, listen, we've been doing the story about Dorsey. We're now doing the story about Crenshaw. It's one story. It's two schools, both in the heart of the black community, both fighting around a similar educational model. In terms of picking your causes, I think this is a really important one. I think our listeners got to really dig in a little bit and start coming to these meetings, give money, show up. So let's get some information one more round about how to reach you all. And remember, this is going to be on our website, Voices from Frontlines. Alex and Reverend Lee, we're going to This interview is going to go up there, so you want to tell your people that if they didn't hear it today, it'll be up on KPFK tonight. It'll be on Voices in a day or two. So let's use that site as also. We're going to put it up on the Action Center for the 27th. So give the last pieces of information, and we'll have you on again, and then we'll have you on until we win.
We're having the community meeting on Tuesday, November 27th, 6:30 at 3018 West 48th Street. It's the African American Cultural Center.
Okay.
And we encourage everyone to come so that we can together stop this takeover of our community school.
Well, Reverend Eric Lee and Alex Caputo-Pearl, thank you so much for being in studio with us, and a very important cause, and we'll work together and try to win this thing.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks
good to have
Eric.
You both.
Thank you.
All right. We're going to take a break for a little bit, folks, and then we're going to be back with Sam Gindin and Leo Panitch to talk about the U.S. Empire. And we've been talking about the U.S. Empire in the first half, too. So we'll keep going.
KPFK would like to thank the following list of growers and producers from the Santa Monica Farmers Market for food donations to our KPFK Fall Fund Drive. Florabella Farms, thanks James and Don. Summer Harvest Farm, a shout out to Susie. Pedro's Ranch, Sea Canyon Orchard, Flying Disc Ranch, thanks Christine. Shaner Farm, Finley Organic Farms, thanks again Brandon. Rocky Canyon Farm, Munich Ranch, thanks Hugo. Fairhill Farms, Haas Apple Farm, Polito Family Farms, Tutti Frutti Farms, big shout out to Barbara. Tenorelli Orchards, thanks John. Bezian's Bakery, Fairview Gardens, thanks to Monica and Maggie. Organic Pastures, and a special thanks to Israel Foyer. When you frequent these establishments, please thank them for donating to your favorite radio station, KPFK.
Hey everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming live on the web on kpfk.org. And as I said, I'm your host, Eric Mann. I'm here with two friends and colleagues, Sam Gindin and Leo Panitch, and they've written an important new book called The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire. Now, I've known these two brothers for well over 20 years. They're very active in the Canadian labor movement, the Canadian left. They have very, very good ties to the actual working class. Leo is Canada Research Chair in Comparative Political Economy in the Department of Political Science at York University, Toronto. He's the editor of the Socialist Register since 1985. His books include Working Class Politics in Crisis, The End of Parliamentary Socialism, and Renewing Socialism, Transforming Democracy, Strategy, and Imagination. Sam Gindin is the former research director of the Canadian Auto Workers. He's PACA chair in the Social Justice at New York University. His many publications include In and Out of Crisis, The Global Financial Meltdown, and Left Alternatives with Greg Albo and Leo Panitch. So Sam and Leo, really good to have you.
Great to be here.
Now, one of the things I know about your book is that you, for a moment, you want us to sort of strip away the state in terms of the armed state and try to understand how imperialism works as an economic system. We're going to get to later why we need to know it. But Sam, why don't you start out, like, what are some of the basic elements of this book that would say this is what makes our book different and why we wrote it?
Well, one of the things about globalization is that it's often treated as if it's a natural development that just emerges out of institutions getting bigger and getting global. And even in Marxism, there's a notion of capitalism having this tendency to go global. But the point is that it isn't inevitable. There's all kinds of barriers to it happening. And when you look at the 1900s, the first half of the 20th century, it actually looked like globalization, global capitalism, wasn't possible. You had wars, you had the Great Depression. And so the question is, well, what changed and what made it possible? And what we put at the center of this question of what made it possible was the American state. And so the American state was fundamental to the making of global capitalism and then to also managing it, because it's a system that's always full of crisis.
Well, basically, I think what you're arguing is certainly by the end of World War II that the United States not just won the war, but basically won the argument within the capitalist camp that there needed to be more of a unified capitalist system with the United States as the chair of the board and other people being cut in. Is that fair? Leo?
Yeah, that's a very fair account of what happened, although one needs to say it was empire by invitation. They didn't just win the argument. The European and Japanese capitalist classes looked to the American state to reproduce capitalist societies, which might not have stayed capitalist if the United States hadn't done so. And it began the process of the world's capitalist classes looking to the United States as their state, as the state that protects them. And in that sense, you know, we tend to think of empire as something imposed. What has been distinctive about the American empire is that it presents itself as representing the interests of global capital. And in some senses, that's not entirely just bullshit, if I may use that expression on the air. Because the kinds of protections that the American state tries to secure in international law are not just protections for American multinationals or American banks. They play the role of trying to secure the protection and free movement of all capitals. And it's partly for that reason that other capitals look to the United States as their state.
Well, then how would you explain Vietnam?
Well, Vietnam was a geostrategic war. It was a war based on the premise that they had lost China. A portion, a very significant portion of Asia had been closed to capital accumulation. Again, not simply American capital accumulation, but Japanese accumulation, etc. And there was this fear that if Vietnam went, you'd get the domino effect. Especially with an Indonesian Communist Party of a million members and other Communist parties in the region. So that's what drove them into it.
So you do agree that one of their goals was essentially to force people. You said it's a voluntary empire, but in this case, don't you think it's fair to say it was a very forced empire to say that we want you to be in the world market whether you want to or not? What do you think, Sam?
Yes, there's no question about the fact that force is used when you're concerned about countries leaving global capitalism or capitalist elites there being defeated. So, but the purpose of the kind of empire you want to build through that is, in fact, to, once that has happened, to integrate them, as you see with Vietnam. You know, what happens after the Vietnam War is the U.S. in one sense loses the war, but in the other sense, Vietnam is now integrated into a global capitalism. And it's integrated through its own state and, you know, its own emerging bourgeoisie that want to be part of, that see that integration into global capitalism as the way for them to accumulate and expand.
Well, let's talk a little bit about strategy and tactics. The show's called Voices from the Frontlines. A lot of the people who listen to the show are public school teachers fighting privatization of their own schools. They're immigrant workers right now. They're people in the front lines of the labor movement. So they're interested in Marxism. They're interested in capitalism. They're interested in imperialism, mainly with the goal of getting rid of it. So you're both activists, scholars, and scholar activists and organizers. What do you think, as you're trying to think through your book, I realize it doesn't mainly lead directly into practice, but what would you think some of the implications would be if you read this book and agreed with you? What would you do differently before you read the book?
Well, you know, I think part of the point of the book is to show the extent to which even the reforms that gave us a better public education, that gave us some elements of a welfare state, were structured in such a way, and not only in the United States, also in Canada, which you guys think of as your Sweden, but even in Sweden,
right,
were structured in such a way as to reproduce capitalism, as to reproduce capitalist labor markets. You know, the obvious example is unemployment insurance. You know, you have to work for a while in order to be able to get on it. If you're unemployed, it only lasts for a certain amount of time. The discipline of the labor market, the discipline of needing to go and sell your labor to somebody else, still operated through that. And that is largely true of the types of welfare states that were even introduced in Europe under the Marshall Plan. And although those were real victories, what began to happen as when you got full employment and certain welfare state protections. Well, working people felt fairly confident and were making economic demands to be able to consume like the system told them that they ought to consume. And those economic demands were squeezing profits back in the 1960s and 70s. And everywhere, the United States leading this with the Reaganite type of interventions against the public sector, against those welfare reforms, was to begin to impoverish those social services, to impoverish public education. And again, part of our point is that part of the response of the liberal and even social democratic left to that was to demand that people should have, well, they aren't going to have good public services, let them at least have access to markets. Let them form private community schools rather than a good public education system, right? Let them get hold of mortgages via the banks rather than massive program of public housing to save American cities. And in that way, neoliberalism tried to solve the problems of capitalism by pulling workers into it as individual consumers, broke their collective spirit, if you like.
And in terms of your work, Sam, in the trade union movement, I mean, obviously one of the challenges has always been that individuals are trying to sell their labor power at the highest price possible. They, to some degree, perceive it as, I work, I get money, I buy. The union was trying to say, no, there's more to life than that. There is a collective life, a direction of a socialist life. How do you see these new economic changes leading closer to the possibility of socialism or further away?
Well, one way is maybe to go back, you know, where Leo was heading in terms of looking at this historically, because there's still a lot of people who see neoliberalism as a bad policy. Maybe we can go back to the good old days. And I think that's very true of a lot of the labor movement, which actually after the war began to think in terms of, well, maybe capitalism can slowly, over time, give us that good life. And the reality of that earlier period, as Leo was emphasizing, there's two things to it. One was you begin to see the making of global capitalism back in that post-war period. This is the period in which you're starting to move towards free trade and you're starting to move to multinational corporations going abroad. You're moving to financial markets going abroad. And you're defeating that part of the labor left and the left more generally that had a different notion of change, that was thinking about changing power, about democratizing industry, about getting democratic control over investment. That was defeated. So labor's militancy was channeled into that kind of individual consumerism. I'm just a worker. I have to sell my labor, that's lousy, but compensate me with consumption. And so one thing is the stage was being set for another capitalism, and the other was the contradictions. That a militant workforce, because of full employment in the 50s and 60s, became a problem for American capital and for the American empire. Became a problem because it was affecting profits, became a problem because it was affecting inflation, which was leading to a loss of confidence in the dollar. And then the labor movement was broken. And now what we have to recognize is there's not a good and a bad capitalism. This is what capitalism is now. And the way that the labor movement was broken was not just that it was attacked. Obviously, it was attacked. The PATCO strike, the high unemployment were direct attacks. But labor was also integrated. They were, again, channeled into trying to solve their problems individually. By individually, I mean through working longer hours, going into debt. And the logic of that over time means that the collective capacities and skills of resistance atrophy.
I'm listening. You're listening. That was Sam Gindin, and you're listening to Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin, their new book, Making a Global Capitalism. We've had him at the Strategy Center today. It's been a fascinating conversation. This is your host, Eric Mann. I mean, you know, during the civil rights movement, one of the demands of the mainstream civil rights movement was called integration. And I always thought that was very funny. We demand integration. And the opposite, of course, was segregation, but I don't think the double entendre is that the system said that's exactly what we're trying to give you is integration into a capitalist system. Mm-hmm. So how do you build a movement that – what does the new capitalism look like in terms of the options for the working class? As you say, you can't wish for a different one. So what are the contours of the present capitalism? And if you don't want to get integrated, what would it look like to not get integrated?
Well, you know, to start with, the main institution that workers had for defending themselves, the union, it was, at a particular moment in capitalism, after the war, a vehicle for making gains. It was a vehicle in which you could make gains, even if you just tried to represent your own narrower group of workers, and that could spread. And that period is over. So one of the contours we have to confront is a certain era is over in capitalism in which you could make gains simply by acting in those sectionalist ways. And it poses the question of having to build new kinds of working class organizations that focus on class. Now, some of that means developing class institutions outside the workplace in terms of in the community. And I think what the Bus Riders Union is doing is really exemplary in doing that. But it also means having these kinds of organizations outside of unions that can also influence unions, because unions still are so important in terms of their organizational strength, in terms of their resources, and in terms of their position, you know, at the point of production, which can be powerful.
Well, Leo, one thing is both you and Sam are now university-based. You have very strong ties to the union movement and social movements. How do you see the present university in terms of worker education, in terms of bringing some of these ideas to the working class? Are you hopeful about the university? Are you concerned about it? I don't have a good feel for what's going on right now.
Well, we happen to be in a very good situation at York University. It has the most radical political science department in the world.
Right.
And, you know, once you establish that, you start getting people from all over the world trying to come there because they can't get it anywhere else. So we're in a rather unique situation. And the people who do come are the type of students who want to become intellectuals that are of use to popular struggles. And that's very important. This is, however, rare. And what is quite remarkable is the defeat that Reaganism and Thatcherism visited on intellectual life is still lingers. And, you know, it lingers more in Europe than it does in Canada. Mm. It is very depressing to go to not only the UK, but to Germany and other countries in Europe and see the extent of that intellectual defeat. Some of it was self-inflicted. It was, you know, former radicals from the 60s who grew cynical about the working class. Some of them opted for movements, the women's movement for a period, then more cultural movements, etc. And they developed a form of radicalism which was very anti-class, anti-political organizations, right. Saw the attempt to get beyond capitalism as inevitably leading to totalitarianism. That's part of the zeitgeist of our time, and you meet that now amongst radical students who protest a lot, but are against any form of organization and naively believe you can change the world by changing discourse. And although changing the language with which we talk about politics is very important, that isn't enough.
Well, I think, you know, we all come out of a tradition of believing that, you know, the most organized class in the world, of course, is the capitalist class. So to tell everybody else that you don't want organization is pretty bizarre. But let's go back now to your book in a certain way, which is, so given that the capitalist class is such great organizers, which they are, both ideologically and institutionally, what are they up to right now? How would you explain some of the new wrinkles in capitalist organization?
That's a very important question. I think part of our point actually is that the capitalist class doesn't organize itself. There are trade associations, the bankers do meet together. There is Davos, which is the equivalent of the World Social Forum, which is borrowed from the Economic Social Forum, where they come together and ski and drink and do all kinds of other things, but also discuss how the world should be run. But in fact, our main point is that capitalist states are really the terrain on which capital's knowledge and interest and strategies get organized. And that's the permanent state. That's the Treasury, the Federal Reserve, etc. And those guys who get elected, including on the basis of, you know, millions and billions of dollars of private funds from capitalists, they get socialized by that permanent state apparatus. And it's that permanent state apparatus that does a reading, and they're technically trained to do it, of what does the system need to contain crises,
to extend capital accumulation. Sometimes, and this wasn't only true of Roosevelt in the 30s, sometimes even in the neoliberal era, against what capitalists are asking for. So if you say to me now what's on the agenda, I don't think it's impossible, as we are 5 years into this global economic crisis, the first great crisis of the 21st century, that they don't seem to be able to get out of. I don't think it's impossible that you're going to see the state disciplining capital to accept a kind of stimulus, and perhaps even borrowing in order to get construction companies going in massive capital projects, etc. The IMF is actually calling for this, and the IMF doesn't do anything that the U.S. Treasury doesn't want it to do. You see this in the New York Times constantly saying Europe and its policy of austerity is a disaster. We need stimulus. You see it in the Financial Times, which is the counterpart of the Wall Street Journal, which takes this position. It's going to take, you know, some initiative on the part of the technocrats in the Treasury to do that. If they did, if they read the Riot Act to Wall Street would call off the congressional Republicans, you can be sure. You could have the stimulus
there. I just want to add a couple of things to it. I mean, one is that in the context of actually waiting and supporting austerity before they do this, it actually gave them an awful lot of time to really hammer public sector unions and to erode a lot of social programs. So they've gained, meanwhile, a lot of those things. But then the other question is, if they do decide that they have to stimulate because they have to save capitalism, it's still a question of what they stimulate. It isn't just that stimulation is itself progressive. They can spend it on the military.
That's right.
And even if they spend it on things we consider progressive, like public transportation, as you've been arguing, there's different ways to spend money on public transportation based on a class perspective.
Well, one of the things that's been concerned to me is that when Obama first got in, and there was obviously a massive economic crisis, the refusal to use $300 billion in public funds to rebuild the housing market, to subsidize bad loans, so-called bad loans, to allow refinancing, which is right in the stimulus package. One of the things I'm concerned about is that a lot of that wealth is lost permanently. A lot of the jobs to me seem to be lost permanently. My daughter is in her early 30s and has so many friends who are living at home, so many friends who are almost making up jobs, and who are in the most marginal relationship to production. Do you see that as reversible inside of a capitalist logic?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that strikes us as we've been going around the country, we keep talking about the American empire, and then you go through places like Detroit, and you go through Baltimore, and you go through virtually any major city, and you see this, you know, the two sides of capitalism. And one of the points about it is it was like this before the crisis.
That's right.
You know, the problem with capitalism is what it looks like even when it's working well. Now, in terms of the present moment, this is how capitalism restructures. Certain jobs are going to be gone forever. But, you know, before the crisis, the unemployment rate was 4.7%. The problem is, what are those kinds of jobs? And what kind of jobs are people forced into because they have no options? So it's hard to look ahead at capitalism and not worry that for people, things can continue to get worse, even while for capital, things get better. And that the two are, in fact, related. The way capital has been able to solve its crisis, and capitalist states have been able to solve its crisis, it's a key point about empire, is by weakening the working class and doing it at the expense of the working class.
This is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines, KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, on the web. And do check out the web at kpfk.org. Also, please check out my new website. It's called voicesfromfrontlines.com. We lost the, so it's voicesfromfrontlines.com. It's got both this radio show. It's also got my blogs at Eric Mann Speaks. It's got an action center, which has different actual populist struggles on it. So we would love to hear what you have to say. And you also can reach us at voices@voicesfromthefrontlines. So we'd love to get your emails. We'd like you to come on the website. So in our last few minutes, I'm with Sam Gindin and Leo Panitch. When I always talk to organizers after a while, I say, so where's the hope? Because On one level, we have to be absolutely sober and look at capitalism in its most honest form. There's no, tell no lies and claim no easy victories. But on the other hand, people wake up in the morning with some hope. So I wanted to start with your own. What gives you hope as you take this book around? You're trying to explain to people the actual workings of imperialism, but given that, we'll start with you, Leo. What's hopeful to you as you travel around the countries?
Well, I find hopeful, although some people find it depressing, a more sober understanding that the kind of compromise secured with capital in Europe is no longer lasting. You know, Americans in particular used to look to Canada as their Sweden, right. And Canadians used to look to Sweden as the socialist Valhalla. And, you know, what's happened the last 20 years is that the growth and inequality in Sweden has been the greatest in the OECD. Now, they were starting from a much more equal point than we were. Right. But, and you've seen a development of a, you know, rampant capitalism in Europe. And unions have been complicit in it because they've joined in the competitiveness game. So the fact that people are seeing this means that they're beginning to understand that the type of politics they need is not one that looks to some example in, you know, German trade unionism or the Swedish welfare state. They're beginning to have a much better sense of the stakes involved. That makes me hopeful. And what also makes me hopeful, and I really think that this needs to be stressed to your listeners, is that traveling across this country, we find more activists of the type that are in your organization, in the Bus Riders Union, than in this country. Developed organizers with a clear perspective on how we need to build up our people's capacities to really run the world. We find more of that going on here than we do in Canada and than we do in Europe. And I think it has to be said than in many countries of the South. And that makes me hopeful. That doesn't mean that they've figured out a formula for changing this incredibly powerful and chaotic system. But I am very hopeful when I see the number of very capable young people who are dedicated to this task of building the organizational capacity to change the world.
And well, you know, I've done a book called Playbook for Progressives, 16 Qualities of a Successful Organizer, and we've sold 5,000 copies already, which is pretty good, and it's gone around the country. And the exciting thing is of the 5,000 people, most of them are the very organizers you're talking about, and there's a tremendous period of introspection right now, and people are not arrogant, they're not depressed at all, but they're really trying to say, look, at the election, after the election, hopefully of Obama, very hopefully of Obama, we're going to be in big trouble. And after the election, if there's the election of Romney, we're going to be in very, very deep trouble. So I think everybody is sort of excited about the election, but feeling like in 3 weeks, we're going to have some very long-range conversations about where this movement is going. Sam, you still have a few more minutes. Tell us some basis your optimism.
Well, it really overlaps with what both of you are saying. When you talk to working people, you don't have to tell them that capitalism sucks. Right. Their lives suck. They know it from their daily experience. And the difficulty, the problem is this question of fatalism. The question of, well, what can I do about it? There's no structures I see of working through. And the hope comes in the fact that there's a lot of energy amongst young people, and I think they're learning something. There's a lot of energy that's gone into things that weren't that productive, but there seems to be a discussion about that, and that is hopeful. And, you know, what's hopeful is this contingent thing. Can we actually identify the crucial issue as the question of organizing? And I think that's starting to happen. People are beginning to have those kinds of honest discussions about organizing, not just about what would be a nice policy, but actually how do you build the capacities to understand the world, to strategize, to have democratic debates with each other. Right. And by the way, I've passed your book on to a lot of organizers, and they're really excited by it because they see, yes, this is the kind of thing we need. We need to talk about organizing.
Well, we'll sort of end with that because I think that's very important that, you know, we have at the Strategy Center, we call consciousness, leadership, and organization. And in my book, I say that, you know, one of the things about organizers is that by their very nature, they're optimistic because you do wake up in the morning with the goal of trying to make something happen. And if you have other people with you, if you're in a shop, as you know, in a very bad trade union leadership, but if you're sitting with 15 other workers that really want to challenge something, it's not depressing. You sit around and say, what are we going to do? And then there's progress and there's regress. So I think this is an important thing as you go around the country that could really help, because I think repopularizing the concept that, you know, we know coming from the labor movement that the CIO was not built, it was organized, you know, and that the amazing people that went into those factories. So in terms of your teaching labor history, in terms of using your book, The Making of Global Capitalism, bringing your own sort of, if I can say, your synthesis as revolutionary intellectuals who have real ties to the working class and a socialist theory. Very nice having you on the show. So this is Sam Gindin. It's Leo Panitch. The book is called The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of American Empire. I do urge you to get it. It's really interesting, and I've read a lot of it, and it's really economic history, what it is, and it's the history of a ruling class. So it's really not just history in some abstract way. It's the evolution and the development of the consciousness of the U.S. ruling class and the development of the American empire. And I think it becomes like a baseline from which us organizers got to figure out what is to be done. So take good care. We'll see you next week, Tuesday at 4. This is Eric Mann, your host. Leo, your last word?
Great to be here, Eric.
Sam?
Terrific to be here.
Okay.
Inspiring.
Two great guys and a really fine book. Take good care, and we'll see you next week.
The following are statements by candidates in the KPFK local station board election.
Ali Ahmadpour is a longtime supporter of KPFK for 26 years. He's an Iranian American and has lived in Los Angeles since 1985 when he migrated to the U.S. as a political refugee. He's been an activist for peace and justice since the 1970s and is a professor of art history. His goals in becoming a member of the KPFK local station board are to take part in advancing KPFK and Pacifica to achieving its fullest potential. His decades of activism have taught him many lessons and developed skills that he would bring to KPFK to build coalitions and create a peaceful and effective working environment. His experience would enable him to work effectively with the management team to achieve what is near and dear to all of our hearts, to hear the voices of those who've been pushed aside in our society.
The preceding statements by the candidates does not necessarily reflect the views of the station or its staff. More information about all of the candidates can be found at kpfk.org.
You are listening to KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 Santa Barbara, 93.7 San Diego, and 99.5 Ridgecrest and China Lake.
KPFK would like to thank the following list of growers and producers from the Santa Monica Farmers Market for food donations to our KPFK Fall Fund Drive. Florabella Farms, thanks James and Don. Summer Harvest Farm, a shout out to Susie. Pedro's Ranch, Sea Canyon Orchard, Flying Disc Ranch, thanks Christine. Shaner Farm, Finley Organic Farms, thanks again Brandon. Rocky Canyon Farm, Munich Ranch, thanks Hugo. Fairhill Farms, Haas Apple Farm, Polito Family Farms, Tutti Frutti Farms, big shout out to Barbara. Tenorelli Orchards, thanks John. Bezian's Bakery, Fairview Gardens, thanks to Monica and Maggie. Organic Pastures, and a special thanks to Israel Foyer. When you frequent these establishments, please thank them for donating to your